Blog Talk Radio.
Coming to you since 1997 on KKUP Radio with over 250 guests and still going strong in their 12th year of weekly broadcasting, the International Taz and Paula Show brings to you expansive, engaging, and groundbreaking intensity on radio and now on the internet airwaves today. Listen live every Thursday or visit Embracing Mother Earth's archives, exclusive articles, ask questions, and receive actual answers from guests anytime at TazandPaulaShow.com. Taz and Paula's special guests are experts coming from all walks of life, energizing our lives with a passion that inspires and teaches us with each of their compelling personal life journeys, with roots from ancient wisdom and bridging it with modern science. We hope today's show touches the wisdom of your heart. And now, Taz and Paula.
Well, welcome, Ben. We are so glad to have you with us. I'm Paula Nunes.
And I'm Taz Powers. And we have Ben Middleton with us today. He is a documentary filmmaker. He turns the camera on himself when confronted with the same open heart surgery that derailed his father's life. In the year following his surgery, Ben struggles with a difficult recovery, and the news of his mother and wife now have life-threatening illnesses of their own. Being there for them becomes the secret road to his own recovery and his freedom from the fear of dying. This beautifully interwoven documentary portrays, with rare humor and spirit, an ordinary man struggling to survive and heal the women he loves.
Well, Ben moved to Los Angeles working as a character actor in Hollywood for about over 20 years, and he was in shows including Cheers, Frasier, Cagney and Lacey, L.A. Law, and he also was in featured films such as Moving Violations. Now, Ben, after having such an active life, I bet it was so hard to find out that maybe your health was not like you thought it should be.
Well, it was a big surprise. I mean, I had been an athlete in college. I had been there on scholarship to play soccer at Franklin and Marshall College back east in Pennsylvania. And I continued my my sports curriculum, as I would call it, all through my life. And what had happened was I was being insured for a small low-budget film when the doctor who usually looks at you on these insurance interviews and says, okay, you're breathing? Well, go to work. He said to me, well, did anyone ever tell you you had mitral valve prolapse? And when I heard the word mitral valve, I was really surprised because it was the same heart disease that my father had had when I was 16 years old that literally changed his life. I mean, he had had his mitral valve replaced by Denton Cooley of the Bakey and Cooley in Houston, Texas in 1966, and he was never the same after that. It was a very traumatic experience for our family, and just thinking that I was now open to that the same disease was a big surprise, and I certainly was scared about it.
Now, did you have any symptoms?
At the time, not really. You know, when you have prolapse, it's just a little bit of a leaking heart valve. But and they had said to me originally that they were going to be able to take care of it by just giving me some blood pressure medicine that would relieve it and that I would be able to live the same life I'd had always. And but what happened in what seemed to be a very short period of time was that I started to become symptomatic, and I developed a very rapid heartbeat, tachycardia. It came upon me one night. I was in New York doing some business, and I was sitting at a restaurant and took my first bite out of a big cannoli, and my heart flipped over as if I had just run a 100-yard dash. I mean, it was now doing 200 beats a minute. And I originally thought I was having a heart attack, and then I realized I wasn't, and I tried to do some yoga breathing and take my heart rate down. And I couldn't, and I finally got myself back to my hotel room and just lied in bed. I called everybody I knew, and of course nobody was home. And I didn't really have the wherewithal or the smarts to take myself to the hospital. I just thought I would get over it, which I did. I came back and I told my cardiologist about it, and he said, well, it was supraventricular tachycardia, and the next time it happened, I needed to get right to a hospital and find out exactly what the rhythms were so it could be treated, and it happened not long after that, and I drove myself over to UCLA, left the car running in the parking lot, and went in, and it's a teaching hospital, and before I knew it, there were 20 eyes looking up at the monitor over my my head, and they said, you know, we're going to give you something to take down the heart rate. And I said, no, I just had this in New York. It's going to go away. And they said, well, you know, when your heart gets up to this rhythm, you're a candidate to have a heart attack, and it's our protocol to bring it down. And so he gave me a syringe that was about the size of a horse needle, and put it in this intravenous line. And I'm looking at these 20 eyes looking past me, and I could see that there was no response. And I said, well, nothing happened. He said, no, it didn't work. Get two. And so they gave me two doses, and I could feel that something happened in my chest. And what I later learned is that they give you a drug that literally stops your heart for about 10 seconds, and then it starts up again in its normal rhythm. So that's when I knew that I was having a heart problem and that I needed to see about having it mended.
What was it like to find out you needed heart surgery?
It's a bit surreal. Especially after having seen what it did to my father. My father had been a very vital man. He was, you know, everybody likes to think of their father this way, but he was everybody's favorite. He was a great storyteller. He was the center of attention when people came to our house. He was a violinist, and he would play for all our parties. And he left for Houston, Texas, to have his valve replacement. And when he came back, he was on Coumadin medicine, and he was a guy that had gone down, and he weighed over, you know, 200 pounds, and was 5'11", great looking. I used to say he looked like he was a cross between Tyrone Power and Dean Martin. And he came back, and he weighed 135 pounds.
Oh.
And, he had this cowboy hat on his head that my mother had got him at the airport. That was too big for him. And I'll never forget him walking up our driveway, and my mother had said that she had promised that she was going to bring him back, and she did. And we were lucky to have him another 5 years. But when I found out that I was a candidate for the same surgery, I just feared that I might have the same experience that he did.
Did he resume a lot of things that he did when after the heart surgery? I mean, was he the same person? Or did he, you know, go downhill after that? Did he lose his normal strength?
No, he really wasn't the same. He never really put the weight back on. They had always said that he would be able to play the violin again, but he never was able to play it again because he had too much pain in his chest, and he was on Coumadin, which, you know, is a blood thinner, and when they put when they do a valve replacement, and in those days I don't believe they were using the porcine valves, the pig valves. They were using the porcelain valves. You have to take these blood thinners to keep them from clogging and sticking, and you have to be monitored on that medication. And he always felt that it was keeping him weak. I mean, he really developed a paranoia about his, and he became a different person. He became paranoid about his medical illness. He thought people were plotting against him. At one point, this is in the film, so I don't feel like I'm giving anything away, but and it's part of my life. And I think part of the process of making this film was to address the truths of my own life and dispel any myths I may have had about it. But my mother at one point had to have my father committed to an institution so that he would be able to be given the blood thinners, or otherwise he would have died. And he was there for about 2 weeks, and then they did some therapy with him, and he saw the reason and the rationales for keeping to take the medicine, and he came home. But that was a very dark period in our life, and in a relationship that was a spectacular relationship. They were a great couple. A lot of what this film is centered in is in family and in tradition, and there was a great tradition in our family and a lot of love.
The parallel between your father and you then, as far as when you found out you needed heart surgery, and where did your mind go? I mean, you know, how did you...
Well, I went to... First, I had a friend that had a valve repair. He had the same problem with his mitral valve, and he had found somebody who could repair it. And what I was hearing was that it was better to have your valve repaired than replaced, for the obvious reason that you wouldn't have to be on blood thinning medication for the rest of your life, that your own metabolism would take care of the valve. I mean, the only medication I take for my heart really now is a baby aspirin.
Well, my husband's on blood thinner.
He is on a blood thinner.
Mm-hmm.
Well, then you know that he's probably monitored quite frequently.
Yes.
It's just another stress on your head, if nothing else. But coming from that experience and having seen my father's paranoias, however they were rooted in the truth of medicine. I went to, well, gee, okay, I'm going to have this surgery. Well, I need to find the best surgeon I could find, and there was a whole exploration for me as to finding the right surgeon, somebody who'd had a lot of experience with doing repairs. Of course, they don't know if they can until they actually are inside your heart and see what's going on there. As it turned out, my surgery turned out to be more than they had anticipated. He was able to repair my valve, but he also had to do a repair on another valve and decrease the size of my atrium, because it had increased in size because my heart had been overworking for so many years to compensate for the leaking of the valve.
Now, people that go through heart surgery, and this probably happened to your father, go through a depression period. Did you go through depression?
Yeah, I did. I was depressed afterwards. I mean, I didn't realize I was depressed, but I was very emotional. I mean, there were other things that had been going on before my surgery as well, but I think I was always nervous that I wasn't, having been so athletic, I was always nervous that I wasn't going to be able to be as strong as I was. I mean, I had, you know, I used to run for miles and miles. I lifted lots and lots of weights. I had put my body on the line. I had, during the first Gulf War, I had volunteered to be in the Israeli army and went to Israel. I mean, I was ready to, and that was only out of the fear that Saddam Hussein was going to live up to, you know, he was raining scuds on Israel and saying that he was the next Hitler, and I didn't want to be, you know, sitting back and saying that, well, here was another man claiming that he was going to annihilate the Jews and sit there and do nothing. And so I had volunteered, and I was stationed at a terrorist prison in the West Bank. It was, I guess I'm bringing that up because I had always been willing to use my body, and as an actor, I always felt that I was able to push my body emotionally and physically to find characters. And now I was afraid that I wasn't going to be able to do that again, and I was scared and I was depressed. Before my surgery and after my surgery, I was in therapy, and I was expressing my fears there about the surgery, and I was very let down. And once I had the surgery, every time I had a missed beat, my brain would race, and I was really down.
And what I hear, I think, was happened to your father also, that people may not have realized, because you said he was paranoid. So I think that was part of his depression.
I think that was part of it. I think when we're scared, we tend to think it's never going to change and that we can't find the way through it. I didn't know that it could get better or that it would get better, or you just don't know what's there. And and I was very low, and I was very emotional.
Now, when did you start? You started filming before you knew about your heart surgery, right?
I actually started filming, right. It was before I knew about the surgery itself. I started filming when I found out that I was going to have more tests to see if I needed the surgery. Because having had a career as an actor, and knowing that any of my best work came from the process of using things in my own history that were personal to me, and they affected the emotionality and the behavior that I had created for the character, I knew that in this situation something real was definitely going to happen. I mean, there was no avoiding it, and that anything that I covered would be very alive and honest. And I literally thought it was going to be a story about a very athletic, starker type of guy who was going to go through a physical challenge, and it was going to be a 6-week thing, whatever it was, and I was going to come out the other end. And you know, there's a great saying that man makes plans and God laughs, and that didn't turn out to be what the story was. But I just happened to turn the camera on, and I went through the testing and found out that I was going to need the surgery, and then started to prepare for that.
And your girlfriend at the time, who later became your wife, she was right there beside you the whole time.
That's right.
And so did you, I almost got a sense that you felt guilty because you felt like, because she had cancer and then it came back. So did you have a guilt around this because of all the stress you put her through? Or?
Well, Valerie had, she had been diagnosed with mesothelioma several years before I had these heart problems, and we had been treating it with alternative methods. She had been going to the Bahamas for an alternative therapy. You may know, and your listeners may know, that mesothelioma is a form of lung cancer that's attributed to exposure to asbestos, and it's a very lethal form of cancer. But she, fortunately enough, had somewhat of an atypical presentation. It had been on her diaphragm, and she was able to keep it at bay for quite a long time. And she also had the most incredible spirit and energy. I believe you've seen the film, so you certainly get a sense of Valerie's great spirit and joy of living in the film. I mean, she never complained. And she supported me greatly during my illness. And when I started to come through recovery, and I had a relapse, and that was quite scary. In after my surgery, her cancer turned, and she became very ill, and we started to move into more mainstream cancer treatments for her. And to answer your question, I to this day, and people will tell you one thing or the other, but I know what stress brings onto a body, and I do feel a sense of guilt and responsibility that her having to have been there for me the way she was certainly stressed her, and I may not have given her all the energy to continue to battle off her cancer, and it had turned, and we held each other closely for a long time, fighting off her illness.
But if you can think of it in a degree that you gave her a sense of purpose while she was there for you.
Well, she was always there for me, and perhaps that's true. We were together 21 years, and it was a not your typical relationship. Valerie was older than I. I was Jewish. She was English Anglican. She was a woman of means. I was a middle-class guy from Long Island. And yet we had a great love and an incredible connection. And throughout our relationship, I never really thought I could love Valerie more than I did. And then we decided to get married, and then I did love her more. I don't know what that came from. I don't know what that is. I don't know what that raising of the spirit is. But we did, and we were more connected and more full. And this was after my surgery, and this was also after we had started going into chemotherapy as well.
Did you, when you were filming all of this, did the filming actually become your own counseling, so to speak? I mean, did it give you a sense of looking into things more than maybe you normally would have?
Boy, that's an interesting way of looking at it, because, like I said, I was in therapy during the time, and I was filming my therapy sessions, as you saw. But I was also doing a video diary, where I was forcing myself to confront what it was that I was going through at the time, and just before I went into my surgery, we found out that my mom had colon cancer, and I never told my mother that I was having the surgery because I didn't want that to be on her head as well. I mean, my mother was a typical mother, and I wouldn't say a typical Jewish mother. She was a typical mother. I mean, if she knew that I was about to have open heart surgery, she would have lied in her bed awake at night, and the phone calls wouldn't have stopped, and she would have wanted to be out here. And so I never told her, and I couldn't put off my surgery, so I wasn't able to go back and be with her at that time when she was diagnosed with colon cancer, which she came through very well, and she was in her, she at that time was, I think, 83 years old. And I think doing these video diaries forced me to look at the things that were important in my life and what was happening on a daily basis to me, and not be in any sort of avoidance. And I was you know, I mean, you can see me go through a whole period of trying to spark myself up and talk myself up and try and deal with the good things that were going on for me, but certainly give strong weight to my great fear and depression and emotions.
Now, Taz and I had a conversation before today's interview about how men deal with illness differently than women. I mean, not just generally, not, you know, not every man or every woman deals with it the same, but do you believe that men, because they're losing their masculinity or their worth, deal with illness different than women?
My watching the two models for me, my wife and my mother, deal with their illnesses, showed me how, you know, I think they were great models, and because they were very above board with it. They were confident. They had their complaints, but they rose above it and fought it. And I tried to do the same, but I definitely fell down. I mean, I would be in crying jags that just would go on. And in a way, they were very cathartic for me, because I've always found that when I cry about something, it's usually because I'm scared about it. And once I get that catharsis over with, once I get it flushed out of my body, then I'm able to move on to, then I'm able to tackle it and get on with it. So I wasn't afraid of those emotions. I was overwhelmed by them from time to time, but I wasn't afraid of them. I let them come, and I let them come over me, and then they would pass, and then I would be able to move on with it. But to answer your questions about losing your masculinity, and I think that's something you deal with as a man your whole life. I mean, I think you're threatened in certain situations, first by other men, and then by the fact that you may be losing your own sense of power in the world, and sense of being able to provide for others and or yourself. And I mean, I think that's probably a reasonable analysis of it.
Well, what I've seen by what you are sharing with us right now and sharing in the film, you are able to allow yourself to cry and flesh that out. And not all men are able to do that, some women.
You know, when I originally started working on this film, the working title for it was Surviving. And I think that that's, you know, my mother used to say it all the time when we were young. I mean, she would say, you know, we're survivors. And I always used to think that that was somewhat of a demeaning term. When, you know, I would think, well, we're not survivors, we're doers. We're achievers. We're not survivors. I always thought that survivors was denigrating. But it wasn't. I mean, to be able to survive, it just means to be able to deal with the fates that are coming your way and make your way through them and continue to achieve and to continue to grow and to continue to live and to continue to love. It's just getting through it and finding the mechanisms that work for you. And I think I've found the ones. I mean, whether I intuited it or not, I mean, I had great models in front of me. My father had been a great role model. I mean, from the time I was a boy, I mean, I had heard the stories about how my father had given up his career in the music business to take care of his brother when his brother had lost his leg in a freak accident in the 30s, walking past a construction site in New York, and a and a building elevator, you know, one of the construction elevators dropped on him. He lost his leg, and his brother had a family, a son and a wife, and they were taking care of my dad's mother, and my father was a musician, which was like being an actor. It meant you worked and you didn't work. And he gave it all up, and it was the love of his life, and he was good at it. He played with the Paul Whiteman Orchestra, and he was good. And he gave it up to get a steady job selling, you know, going to the clothing business like his two other brothers, so he could put a paycheck on the table every Friday night for his family. And my mother had done the same in bringing her mother into our house. And so I knew what it meant to go through tough times and be there for the people that you love, that were part of your family. And I was lucky. I mean, I was lucky to have had good models.
And do you think being an actor and really getting in touch with the emotions, I mean, that's what I imagine acting is, helped also?
The answer is yes, I think it did. And they always say that when you work as an actor and you go into any sort of classes and technique and trying to get in touch with who you are and being able to be expressive and be able to express what's... I always say that actors aren't, you know, they're not acting something else. They're just acting what they know, what their own feelings are. And I think part of acting is exploring your feminine side, exploring, you know, all sides of your expressive instrument. And, you know, I first went into therapy with an acting teacher. There were two schools of thought for actors. I mean, and I experienced them right when I went into my training. One of them was the Strasbourg School at the Actors Studio, that, you know, everybody should be in therapy and find out what's really going on with them and get in touch with their emotions. And the other school was a more traditional feeling, was that if you touched on those things and you went into therapy, that you would shoot your wad there and you wouldn't have it to put on the stage, that you would use it up. And I ultimately didn't believe in that. I ultimately believed that it was better to be to get in touch with yourself and have a healthy life than eat yourself up inside.
It sounds like the growth of your spirit and your soul really changed with all of these step-by-step processes that you went through.
Well, Taz, I think that, you know, I wasn't really making the film. I was living my life. I mean, the shooting of the film took place in a 9-month period, and which basically encompassed prior to my surgery, and then through my rehabilitation, and right when Valerie started to get ill, and it wasn't. And then I lived through, as you know, my wife's illness and being the sole caregiver for my aunt and our friend, and then moving back to Virginia to take care of my mom with my sister for 9 months. And I didn't know I had a film, and I was making another film at the time. I was making a documentary about professional basketball players called The Youngest Guns, that was about kids foregoing their education to jump into the pros. And I made that film, and it was I had met a couple of directors. That was my first film, and one director said, "Well, you know, the success of a documentary was simple. You just turn the camera on your subject, and you hope he dies." And I knew it was a metaphor for, well, you just hope something dramatic is going to happen during the course of making it. And I came back, and I had released, the day that The Youngest Guns was released, I was with my mom at Johns Hopkins Hospital. She had a brain tumor, and she had been the most positive and upbeat and always that. And we knew what her wishes were. I mean, here was a woman, now she was 88 years old, completely independent, drove everywhere, did her own shopping, was active in her community, was political, was getting ready for the next political election. And she, we knew her wishes were that if there was a chance at the end of her life, and if something happened to her, she didn't want to be a vegetable, but if there was a chance for her to thrive, she wanted to take it. And so we had taken her up to Johns Hopkins Hospital, and I had met with the head of neurosurgery there, Dr. Henry Brehm, who has become a big advocate for the film and a great friend now. And he said, look, if it was my mother, he said, I would have the surgery. And we knew that that mom would have wanted to take the chance. So I was at Johns Hopkins with her the day that film was released. And she had brain surgery. And then we took her home, and I was there for the better part of 9 months in Virginia. And we had quality life with my mom. And it was only after that that I came back and said, well, what am I going to do with my life now? And I said, well, you know, I never did anything with that heart surgery film, with my heart film. I said, but I don't know what the film is. And I looked at all the people that were in the film, and I saw Val was in that, and I'd had an interview with my mother in that film, even though she didn't know I was having the surgery, and just so I could get her to tell the story of my father's surgery. Because I knew that would juxtapose next to my experience would be interesting. And I had lived through Sammy's life, and I said, well, you know, I've come back, and I turned the camera on the subject, and the subject lived. And then I thought, well, maybe he lived so that he could help other people die. Mm-hmm. And when I looked at that whole arc, and I made the film, I didn't realize that perhaps my character, and I mean it, my own personal character, had grown in the course of all of that experience. Because I certainly learned a lot about myself. I mean, during the course of my own surgery, my own personal support system, whether there were some, certainly Valerie was there by my side every step. But I had friends that disappeared. I had clergy that disappeared. I had some family that I didn't know what happened. And I was angry about it. I was frustrated about it. You see it in the film. And I think I learned something. I learned a couple of lessons from that. First of all, you really never know what's going on in somebody else's life when you're in need. You just don't know what's going on with them. Number two is maybe I just had too big of expectations of other people, and that expectations are not something you can realistically have. And perhaps the most important thing that I learned then was I wanted to be more present for other people when they were in need. When I could sense that they might be in need, I wanted to make sure that I was available. And knowing that some people would be unable to ask for help but were perhaps expecting it, but more importantly, needing it. And so I've become a big advocate for caregivers. You may know that this month is November is National Caregivers Month, and it's something we're all going to experience in some way. They say that one out of four people is going to need caregiving, and probably half of all people are going to need and or be a caregiver at some point in their life. And there's a lot involved with that. And it's also one of the ways to keep health costs down. Having gone into nursing homes and experienced that, I didn't realize what a blessing it was in my life. What a gift it was that my mother gave me at the end of her life, that I was able to go back and take care of her, and we were able to keep her in her own home, and she was able to die in her own home. And the same for Valerie, and Valerie was able to be in her own home. And as difficult as that is to experience and live through, it's a big gift. We spend a lot of time, well worth it, bringing people into the world and being there for them when they come into the world and giving them nurturing. And when people are leaving the world, they deserve the same. and they deserve everything we can give.
You were helping your aunt in your film.
Yeah.
And while you were doing that, my thoughts were you must know how much she needed you and could not ask for that. I mean, it sounded like she was really independent and didn't want to ask for help, but you were there.
I was there. She was the last remaining middleman, and she was really quite a character, my Aunt Bess. And it was very difficult for her to ask for anything. She never wanted to ask anything from anybody. She even expresses that in the film about her childhood, and she wouldn't ask her mother for anything, and her mother only gave to her sister, and she never asked anybody for everything. She saved every penny she ever made. And when I came out of the hospital, we couldn't find Bess. When I came out from my surgery, and we wanted to call her, and my sister said, well, I was afraid to tell you when you're in the hospital, but we don't know where she is. She had gone into the hospital, and she had congestive heart failure. And so now, while I was recuperating from heart surgery, I was the only caregiver that Bess had. So I was traveling out and overseeing Bess's care and being with her and through the end of her life. And, it was a funny relationship. Bess really became my friend. When you see us together, I mean, we are completely from two different worlds. And but she became my friend, and I'm so glad to have had that experience.
Were you close to her before her illness?
I would see Bess when my mother came out to visit. My mother would come out, and she would say, you know, we should call your cousin Bess, you know, your father's cousin. And I would probably say, oh, Mom, you know, I've only got you here for a certain amount of time. She would say, Ben, we need to call Bess. I mean, that's the old tradition of family. And I would say, okay. And we would go out, and I was the young, oh, Ben, you have to come for dinner sometime, and you have to do this. And I would say, oh, okay. Well, then her sister passed away, and then Bess had nobody. And then I started to, it just came on me. I would go out definitely once a week. I would do the shopping. I would get her to a doctor's appointment if she needed it. And we started to tell stories. She would always share stories about my father. I would try and prompt her about some of these things. She complained forever about everything else. She had been a bookkeeper her whole life, never had married. She was on her own, lived to be 89. And then when I had my surgery, and I came out and she was ill, then I had found her an assisted living home to move into, and we did that, and we sold her house, and then we took care of her as things developed. And when I say we, I mean me. I mean, because there was nobody else. So, I mean, that's what it comes down to.
It's pretty amazing. First of all, you know, you're the one that, you know, found out about your health and that you weren't as strong and vibrant as you were when you were younger, and yet, you know, you're knowing what to do to take care of you piece by piece, and therefore just you're transferring all this to others and helping care for them when you know you knew what you needed for yourself, and yet, you know, sometimes it's nice to give to others when they don't have to ask as well.
That's such a good point. I had a great letter written to me about the film. I have an assistant that came to work for me after Valerie had passed away. And at the time, I was really a basket case. I just was putting one foot in front of the other and finishing my basketball film and going into the office, and so I needed somebody to do bookkeeping. And this woman called up and she said, well, would you hire, you know, I'm looking for a job. I've done a lot of bookkeeping. She said, is age a consideration? I said, well, how old are you? And she said, oh, come on. And so I said, okay, come on in. And she came in and she was, well, now she's still working for me and she's 89. And so she's worked for me now 9 years, and she brought a friend of hers to see the film. Her name is Marie Hartman. She's a terrific woman. I will forever be in her debt, because at the time our friend Sam, who was Valerie's and my friend Sam, was we had gotten him into an assisted living place. He had dementia. Valerie was now gone. I couldn't tell Sam that Valerie was gone. And I said, you know, part of Marie's job description was to go visit Sam once a week, and that I would pay her for the time and for the gas and whatever. And she came back from the first meeting with Sam, and she said, you know, she would visit Sam twice a week, and that I would never have to pay her, and she would be doing it in honor of my wife. And those are the types of kindnesses and models that you come across in life.
Wow, that brought a tear to my eye.
that inspire you to move on. And so I'm not sure what I was responding to before that, but that's certainly a story I'm glad to tell, because I think it certainly has helped mold me and mold my character. Oh, I know what it was. And so her friend came to see the film with her. Her friend is also 90, came from Europe, was apparently responsible for saving many Jews during the war and hiding them in Belgium, I believe. And she came and saw the film, and she saw it twice, and then she was going to come back to the premiere, and she wrote me a letter before the premiere. And her son-in-law is a very big columnist down here in Los Angeles, and she was hoping he would come and see the film, and he wasn't able to come with her, and she wanted to write me this letter just saying that he wasn't coming, but that how, as she's watched the film two times, she saw that the film represented different stages of life. The early stages, which you see me in, where I'm still this young, ambitious actor who's going through a crisis that has all this vitality, that so much is concerned about me, myself. All my early tears are about what's happening to me, what's happening to me, what's happening to me. And then she said she saw this arc in the film where Ben realizes that the greatest satisfactions out of life are by doing for other people. And I know it's all cliche, and it seems like cliche, but sometimes cliches are true for a reason. Mm-hmm. And she said that's what she saw in the arc of the film, is that there was a growth to somebody that was really starting to get satisfaction and being able to live by being there for others. And that's something you have to live and try every day. It's not something that necessarily comes naturally, and it's something you just work on and ultimately do.
So when you originally started creating this film, I'm sure that's you didn't have any idea that that's the message that was going to come from the film.
No, not at all. I didn't. No, because I probably already thought I was that guy. So I probably always thought, well, I'm a really, you know, I am this guy. It turned out to be something entirely. It was a different roller coaster than I could have ever imagined having been on. As difficult as so much of it was, the amount of love that gets opened up in your own body and soul when you're forced to confront these types of challenges, which are the inevitable challenges that everybody faces. And my life was no different than anybody else's. It's just I had a camera turned on, and some of these things were compressed into a shorter period of time. But everybody is going to face, everybody comes up against the same things. And so it's just that I turned this camera on because I thought it was going to be a chance to show some truths about life, and I didn't realize how expansive that would be.
Oh, how true that would be, huh?
Yeah, or how true that would be, exactly. Exactly.
Where do we find this film?
We can find it. Well, it's just being released this week between the 10th and the 17th in DVD at Amazon and on Barnes and Noble and Target online and on eBay online and on our website, which is www.dyingtolivethemovie.com. com. It's Dying to Live the Movie, one word, .com. And it's available now. It's also on Netflix. I mean, you can rent it on Netflix and get on their queue. I think the film is available to be queued in that right now.
Well, I would think that different organizations, because you've touched a spectrum of people that are actually facing their own critical illness, and then there's the caretaker in the movie. So, I mean, this touches the spectrum of people. So I can see where it can help so many different people in all different times of their life.
Well, I believe the film is really representative of the human condition, and whether you're worried about your own mortality, whether you're dealing with spousal illness or parental dependence, or you're just dealing with a complicated love situation, because certainly my relationship was different. It wasn't a traditional standard relationship, but it's the real thing. So love is where it happens for you. I mean, it's magical, but it takes a little bit of work, and it's the most worthwhile thing in the world. So it's all about people. I think that God exists between people. I don't know that it's an up and down relationship. I think it happens between people.
And we were going to touch a little bit on health reform, where we should go from where we're at now. I mean, our country. I mean, we should be there for.
Well, I agree. I mean, what you can see in the film. I mean, it was. You're looking at a lucky guy in the film. I'm very lucky. I'm lucky to have had the people in my life that I've had, for sure, and to have all the experiences that I've had. But I was lucky that I had health insurance, number one, a very good health insurance with the Screen Actors Guild, and I was also lucky that I had the time and the wherewithal, which means the money, to be with the people I loved at the end of their lives, and to be there and to give them care. Not everybody has that, and certainly there are so many people uninsured. When you keep reading the stories day after day about people that don't have health insurance, that are dying in this country and that would be alive if they had health insurance, my feeling is that it's our right as Americans. I mean, certainly in this country, I don't like to use the word the greatest country in the world, but it's certainly we're the most affluent country in the world. We should be able to provide health insurance for all of our citizens, and I think the Congress is on to doing it. I just think that it's all of our quiet majority, because remember, we voted this Congress and this president in. It's the quiet majority's responsibility now to stand up and to make phone calls and to get online and tell people about doing the right thing and moving this legislation. Moving the legislation forward. They always, whenever I see actors talking about politics, I get nervous, and I always kind of diminish it a little bit. But this is a conversation that I'm completely committed to. We should all have health insurance. If I hadn't had health insurance and had been in these situations, or if anybody that I knew, well, I did live through it with Sammy. Our friend Sammy didn't have health insurance. He was on Medi-Cal. Before we knew what happened to Sam when he was in an assisted living place, he had no family. I was the only person that he knew, and because he had been Valerie's houseman for years, and he had become my friend, and now he was alone in the world. He was taken into the state system. He was stuck in a very very bad nursing home. They didn't honor his end of life wishes. He had an advance directive, which is something else we could talk about, because those things are extremely important, to know a person's wishes at the end of their life and to honor them and to find a way to honor them. Sam had an advance directive, and he had died one night on the way to the emergency room, and they brought him back to life with a feeding tube in his stomach, which were not his wishes. And certainly if they were his wishes, I would have honored that. But these were not his wishes. And now, I know it's just a sad story, and it's difficult to tell, and it's difficult for people to hear it. Nobody wants to talk about these things. And yet, you know, when you live through them, you wish somebody would have provided for it in advance. Sam wound up on a feeding tube for months and months, not even being able to watch TV. He didn't know what he was doing. He was being kept alive, not by his own wishes. And it was sad. So, I've seen that, and I'm hoping, and I'm working, and I'm encouraging people to move for healthcare reform now, because if it's another 30 or 40 years, we're not going to be able to be here, not to benefit even for ourselves, but to benefit for me. I have no children. I'd like to see my nephews and nieces be secure and their children. Is that too much of a platform?
I mean, have I
jumped up too loud? I hope not.
But if we don't do that, hospitals will go broke because everybody's going to emergency work because they don't have insurance.
That's right. I mean, that's it too. I mean, I have another friend who's quite old, and that's what she does. She uses the emergency room as her doctor.
Mm-hmm.
And every time she tells me that she's about to do it, I kind of cringe. Well, I think maybe I'll go to the emergency room. Well, it's not like going to get your hair done. You know, whatever that is, it's a couple of $1,000s of people's time.
Let me let people know that we're listening to you, Ben Middleman, and that you have a great documentary and to take a look at it, and it's Dying to Live what is the name of the website? Dying to Live?
DyingToLiveTheMovie.com.
Okay, DyingToLiveTheMovie.com. Don't forget to go there and get your copy. And I just would like to ask you briefly, is there something else on your palette that you want to do that you find yourself doing, maybe a book or a movie, another movie or anything like that? Do we have that?
Well, there are a couple of things that I'm simmering on right now, and I wish I could say it was one or the other. There's a film that I'm exploring in Israel about the Bedouin community, a Bedouin community that wants to become a sustainable community on its own. It's being empowered by the Israeli government to use some of the latest technology at a Ben Gurion University on water distillation and solar panels. But I need to go there and actually meet the people. What I understand about this community of people is that it's a fundamentalist community, but the women have really risen up to take a lead in driving the community to be sustainable. It's based on a Buckminster Fuller model, and for me, you see that I'm very inspired by women. I mean, I'm glad I'm on a women's show, but that women have been great models for me, certainly through my life, and I am empowered by them. And also there's a film up in that I may be exploring in the Bay Area about a friend of mine that passed away recently who was an alcoholic and his friends didn't find out that he had died until 10 days after he was gone. And I just think it's a story about a life that slipped between the cracks, that a man that lived, that was a good man, that I had a lot of laughs with, and he was a kind man, he was a union organizer, and that nobody, that attention needs to be paid to these individuals in our society. I mean, we all know people like this, and a light needs to be shined in this area.
What a perfect ending. So we know you have many other journeys to explore besides this one, and thank you for being with us today.
Thank you very much. Thank you for having me, and thank you for looking at Dying to Live, the Journey into a Man's Open Heart. It's very nice to speak to you.
And have a great day. Thank you.
Thank you. Bye.
Bye-bye.
Thank you.